content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the November 27th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Terror and death on the streets of Paris. What happened? France, the U.S., and Russia took steps to form a grand coalition against the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq this week, as Paris reeled from the worst terrorist atrocity in French history, and security services conducted hundreds of raids to hunt down Islamic radicals involved in the plot. A total of 129 people were killed and 352 injured when at least nine militants attacked the French capital in three coordinated groups last Friday night. The bloodshed began just after 9:20 p.m. when two men blew themselves up outside an international soccer match at the Stade de France. A second team of three men drove around the city, gunning down drinkers and diners at two bars and two restaurants with automatic assault rifles. In all, that group killed 39 people, including 23-year-old American exchange student Noemi Gonzalez. A third heavily armed team stormed into the 1,500-capacity Bataclan Concert Hall, which was sold out for a show by a California heavy metal band, and used automatic weapons to slaughter 89 people before security forces stormed the venue. Survivors said the attackers shouted, "It's the fault of your president, French President François Hollande, for using air power against ISIS in Syria." ISIS claimed responsibility for the atrocities, calling Paris the capital of prostitution and obscenity, and vowing more attacks on the West, including Washington, D.C. Amid vastly heightened security in French towns and cities, police conducted more than 300 raids in France and Belgium to find those behind the attacks. The suspected mastermind, 27-year-old Abdelhamid Aboud of Belgium, was thought to have been killed in a massive raid on a safe house in a Parisian suburb. Declaring the terrorist attack an act of war against France, Hollande vowed a merciless response. He launched several French airstrikes on Raqqa, ISIS's de facto capital in Syria, and made arrangements to visit Washington and Moscow next week to form a grand coalition against ISIS. President Obama said he'd welcome further cooperation, but insisted it'd be a mistake for the U.S. to send in ground troops. "We have the right strategy," he said. "We're going to see it through." What the editorial said: these murderous attacks on France were sad and painful confirmation that ISIS is much more than just a regional threat, said the Washington Post. The group had already taken credit for blowing up a Russian airliner over Egypt and for two deadly suicide bomb attacks in Beirut. Clearly, it is now targeting everyone who aspires to modernity. Obama has sought only to contain ISIS with airstrikes and ground campaigns by Kurdish and Iraqi fighters. But as long as these savage foes enjoy relative sanctuary, other attacks will follow. "The Paris attack is in some ways even more alarming than 9/11, said the Wall Street Journal. "Airplane hijackings have essentially been eliminated through enhanced security. But there's no easy way to prevent suicidal jihadists with assault rifles and grenades." FBI Director James Comey said the agency is tracking thousands of people inside the U.S. who are absorbing Islamic State propaganda on the Internet. Obama must remove the political restraints and drive ISIS out of its territory in Iraq and Syria as rapidly as possible. Kurds and Sunni Arabs will provide most of the fighters if U.S. supplies the firepower, intelligence, and political leadership. If Americans learned anything from 9/11, surely it's the danger posed by an unthinking emotional response to acts of terror, said the Baltimore Sun. Yet hawkish presidential candidates are already clamoring for a big military response, while governors in mainly Republican states are declaring they'll refuse asylum to Syrian refugees because one of the attackers apparently entered Europe with Syrian refugees landing in Greece. We're giving terrorists exactly what they crave, chest-pumping, outsized reactions to the danger they pose. What the columnist said. How did analysts and policymakers underestimate ISIS so badly? Asked J.M. Berger in Politico.com. This is a barbaric, fanatical group with tens of thousands of fighters and cash reserves of hundreds of millions of dollars. Assets that easily lend themselves to attacks on Western targets. Al-Qaeda, by comparison, had well under 1,000 followers when it attacked the U.S. on 9/11, an operation that cost just $500,000. That's why we need to send in a modest force of American, French, and other Western ground troops, said James Jeffrey in the Washington Post. The U.S. may be weary of war, but we no longer have the time to wait for local forces in Iraq and Syria to eliminate ISIS for us. But then what? Asked Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. As we learned so painfully in Iraq, American troops would need to stay there for years, if not decades, to hold ground, and this occupation would serve as a recruitment tool for a fresh crop of terrorists. To beat ISIS, we must damage the group's allure, said Walter Russell Mead in the AmericanInterest.com. The group recruits jihadists with promises of video game-style adventures, marauding across desert towns, firing machine guns from pickup trucks. We need to step up the war of attrition so that life for ISIS fighters becomes a miserable affair of holing up, getting shot, running out of food, and putting up with bad medical care. Whatever course the West takes, the easy days are over, said William Salatin in Slate.com. As our fears of being attacked declined as 9/11 receded, we became more concerned about our privacy than about stopping terrorists. But in a world full of religious violence, all of our options are bad. We can't track every individual terrorist. It takes 25 agents to follow just one. So we have to accept some degree of mass surveillance. We may even need to send more troops abroad. The lull in this war is over. If Madrid, London, or Mumbai didn't wake us up, Paris should. The controversy of the week, defining terrorism. Is it radical Islam or violent extremism? For Democrats, radical Islam is the ideology that must not be named, said Robert Trzesinski in TheFederalist.com. Less than 24 hours after last week's shocking ISIS assault on Paris, the Democratic presidential candidates were asked at a debate if they agreed with Senator Marco Rubio that we are at war with radical Islam. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley all demurred, with Clinton saying she preferred the term violent extremism and stressing the importance of not painting terrorists with too broad a brush. Are Democrats afraid to name the enemy, the way characters in Harry Potter were afraid to name Lord Voldemort? The issue here isn't just the left's painful political correctness, said Ben Dominic in the DailyBeast.com. The refusal by Democrats to call the threat of radical Islam by its name is grounded in the same naivety and wishful thinking that has made President Obama's foreign policy such a disaster, especially his passive, half-hearted response to the rise of ISIS. Until we have leaders willing to grapple with the true nature of today's foe, how can we possibly hope to win? That's an uncommonly stupid argument, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Republicans talk about radical Islam as if it's a magical incantation that once spoken will drive our enemies from the earth. They think it's only the cowardice and weakness of the Democratic Party that keeps Obama and Clinton from using the term. The reality is that ISIS and al-Qaeda's main objective is to convince the world's 1.6 billion Muslims that the West is at war with Islam. This is why responsible U.S. leaders from George W. Bush onward have avoided using anti-Islamic rhetoric that plays into the enemy's narratives. To describe this conflict as a clash of civilizations, as Rubio did last week, is to reinforce ISIS's message that the Christian and Muslim worlds are locked in violent, unresolvable conflict, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Unless we can rally the world's moderate Muslims against the violent fringe element, the West will find itself in an unwinnable struggle. Winning Muslim hearts and minds is indeed our priority, said Ayan Hirsi Ali in Foreign Policy. But that means we have to engage with the ideology of Islamist extremism. The unfortunate reality is that the Quran's 7th century text provides ample support for the belief that armed jihad against non-believers is the duty of all Muslims. To combat Islamic terrorism in all its various forms, we have to help our non-radical Muslim allies win the argument that their modern interpretation of Islam is superior, that it truly should be a religion of peace and tolerance. Separating all Muslims into two categories, radical and not, is overly simplistic, said Joshua Holland in The Nation. There are hundreds of millions of Muslims whose beliefs are radical or extreme by Western standards, including virtually all of Saudi Arabia, but who oppose the use of violence. It's these fundamentalist Muslims who have the greatest influence over the thinking and actions of the Islamic world, and it's their hearts and minds we most need to defeat the violent extremism of ISIS and other terrorist groups. Words matter, said Amber Phillips in WashingtonPost.com. When American or European political leaders call terrorists radical Islamists, it alienates many Muslims and helps groups like ISIS recruit. That said, it's sometimes hard not to wonder if some politicians prefer arguing over how to describe the Islamic State because it's easier than talking about what to actually do about the Islamic State. It was a good week for self-discipline after a Milwaukee cop issued himself a ticket for parking his squad car in a handicapped spot. The rules are the same for my squad car as any car, said Sheriff David Clark. Parking there is inexcusable. It was a good week for nonverbal communication after the Oxford English Dictionary named the face with tears of joy emoji the world's most frequently used digital icon as the 2015 Word of the Year. It was a good week for getting off easy after a Canadian company launched The Breakup Shop, an online service that promises to handle the messy work of breaking up by sending your soon-to-be ex a personalized text for $10, phone call, $29, or handwritten letter, $20, welcoming them to Dumpsville. But it was a bad week for Ben Carson after his top national security advisor complained that the retired neurosurgeon just didn't seem to grasp foreign policy issues. Nobody has been able to sit down with him and have him get one iota of intelligent information about the Middle East, Dwayne R. Claridge told the New York Times. It was a bad week for life in the slow lane after a cop in Mountain View, California, pulled over a self-driving Google car for driving too slowly, 24 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone, and impeding traffic. The officer decided not to issue a summons after realizing there was no driver to ticket. And it was a bad week for safe havens after a bus station in Dorset, England, began blaring bagpipe music over the loudspeaker to keep homeless people from spending the night. "It seems to be doing the job," said one station worker. "You try getting any sleep with that going on." On the briefing page this week, how America rates. Most Americans think their country is the best in the world, but global studies paint a murkier picture. Is the U.S. number one? It is economically. The U.S. is still comfortably the largest global economy with a GDP of more than $17 trillion. Second-ranked China's is only $10 trillion. The U.S. has an average after-tax household income of $41,355, the highest of any of the 34 nations in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, and considerably more than the group's median of $27,630. All five of the world's largest companies by market capitalization, Apple, Microsoft, Exxon, Berkshire Hathaway, and Google, are American. But in its annual study of well-being in developed nations, the OECD found that the material wealth was just one component of happiness. When you have satisfied your basic needs in terms of income, you tend to believe there are things that matter much more than income, says Romani Borani, head of the Measuring Well-Being and Progress section of the OECD. People want quality of life. In terms of overall well-being, the organization found the U.S. is not number one. In fact, it's not even in the top 10, coming in at 15th. Why is that? For two primary reasons. A lot of Americans are isolated and feel a lack of social connection, and our poor work-life balance. Full-time American employees work longer hours than those in other developed nations, an average of 46.7 a week, according to a recent Gallup poll, and take fewer vacation days. They also generally enjoy less sleep and leisure time, an hour a day less than Germans, for example. Our health isn't great either. The U.S. is easily the fattest nation in the group, with 35% of adults either overweight or obese. In Japan, it's just 4%. Our wealth is distributed very unevenly. As a result, we have high rates of childhood poverty and the third highest birth rate among 15 to 19-year-olds, behind Mexico and Chile. America's murder rate, about 5 per 100,000 people, is the second highest in the OECD, behind only Mexico's. What do other surveys say? The U.S. is in the middle of the pack in all of them, The U.S. fell from 12th to 23rd in Gallup's most recent well-being index, which found far more happiness in many Latin American nations, including Panama, Costa Rica, and Belize. Why? Social cohesion is strong in these nations, Gallup says, and people there are most likely to report daily positive experiences such as smiling and laughing, feeling enjoyment, and feeling treated with respect each day. The U.S. comes in just 11th on the U.K.-based Legatum Institute's annual prosperity index, which rates Norway and Switzerland at the top. In that survey, U.S. crime rates pushed us down in the rankings. Some 17% of Americans said they'd been a victim of theft, comparable to Nicaragua, Panama, and Brazil, while only 74% said they felt safe walking alone at night, a level of insecurity comparable to Egypt's and Serbia's. Which countries are happiest? Well-being studies are consistently topped by the Nordic countries, the Scandinavian trio of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, along with Finland and Iceland. The so-called Nordic model involves high taxes and universal social welfare. In Denmark, for example, everyone receives free national health care. By law, new mothers get 18 weeks fully paid maternity leave, and students pay no tuition. These benefits don't come free, of course. Top earners pay as much as 57% income tax, while those in the middle brackets fork out up to 48%. Because of high taxation, consumer goods are far more expensive. A new iPhone 6S, which cost $650 in the U.S., costs more than $1,000 in Denmark. But the Nordics generally like life under their system. In the UN's most recent World Happiness Report, which ranked Switzerland number one, the Nordic nations ranked second, third, fourth, sixth, and eighth. The U.S. was 15th. What do those indexes tell us? Happiness is very subjective, making it hard to rank nations that have widely differing value systems. Americans have always put a high value on personal liberty, individual autonomy, and climbing the economic ladder. As a result, we have more discretionary income and consumer goodies than nations rated as happier. We cannot all be like the Nordics, said MIT economist Darren Akamuga, but there is something we can learn from the Nordics and the Latin Americans. Studies have found that, in general, the golden triangle of happiness consists of financial security, a sense of purpose in life, and strong personal relationships and social connections. People are social creatures and get pleasure from spending time with others, Borini of the OECD said. To be happier, experts suggest, Americans should work a little less, spend more time with friends and family, and become more deeply engaged in organizations in their communities. Seeking gross national happiness. Since 1971, the tiny Himalayan country of Bhutan has refused to use GDP as the overarching way to measure progress. Instead, the nation has focused on gross national happiness by asking its citizens about how they feel on a variety of indicators, from health and education to emotional fulfillment and the environment. Officials determine where to focus their attention and funding. In 2011, the UN passed a resolution encouraging other countries to follow Bhutan's example. Four U.S. states, Maryland, Vermont, Oregon, and Colorado, now use a genuine progress indicator that works along similar lines. But opponents are pushing back, arguing that Bhutan's system has failed to deliver results. Most citizens remain impoverished. Political corruption is widespread. Suicide rates are high. Bhutan's government may even be cooling on gross national happiness. Prime Minister Sherin Tobgay has called the concept a distraction. But the UN is still a believer. Happy people live longer, are more productive, earn more, and are also better citizens, the organization noted in its 2013 World Happiness Report. Well-being should be developed both for its own sake and for its side effects. Moving on to the columns now. We'll take one this week from the U.S. The emptiness of Facebook empathy. In the immediate aftermath of the Paris attacks, millions of Facebook users put red, white, and blue picture filters on their homepages. While Twitter users tweeted out such hashtags as hashtag pray for Paris and hashtag je suis Paris. But do these well-meaning signs of solidarity really accomplish anything? Asked Gracie Olmsted. Online social media campaigns generally make us feel good about ourselves without forcing us beyond our spheres of comfort. Twitter and Facebook provide a comforting illusion that you've taken an important stand, which may be counterproductive because it removes the need to actually do something. Remember hashtag bring back our girls, the hashtag created in the wake of Boko Haram's kidnapping of hundreds of teenagers in Nigeria? By the time the next hashtag campaign came along, the stolen girls were all but forgotten. Think of the agony facing Parisians whose friends and loved ones were slaughtered in the massacre. If we are to be honest, while we can try our best to empathize, both emotional and physical distance will keep us apart. Let's hope the terrified and grieving citizens of Paris experience true and immediate compassion in the days to come, not just the superficial kind found in 140 characters. This column is from Spain. When junk rains down from space. Houston, we have a problem, said Milagros Perez Olivia. Debris is raining down on Spain from outer space, and pretty soon somebody is going to get hurt. Over the past 2 weeks, three bizarre-looking man-made objects have landed in southern Spain. The first two in the Murcia region were dense black roundish things a full meter in diameter, and bomb squads were called to investigate them. The third, found in a farmer's field in neighboring Valencia, was a long metal piece that could have come from some kind of aircraft or spacecraft. We know there are millions of fragments of space junk orbiting the planet, including remnants of old satellites, rockets, and past missions. But for years, we naively believed that any chunk that fell out of orbit would simply burn up and disintegrate when it hit the atmosphere, and therefore pose no danger to Earthlings. Alas, that theory has now been proved wrong. But how can we protect ourselves? It's going to be tough to devise a garbage collection system to go sweep in space, and expensive. In any case, Spain is not responsible for most of the mess cluttering the sky, even if for some reason we are the landing site. The solution will have to be international. In this column from Australia, removing the stigma of adoption. Adoption is practically taboo in Australia, and children are suffering because of the stigma, said Jeremy Samut. Of the 43,000 children living in foster homes or other care last year, just 89 were adopted. Authorities are reluctant to permanently sever ties to biological parents, even if they're abusive. When kids are removed from the family home, they are often sent back again and again in a cycle of maltreatment and instability. The fetishization of the biological family stems from Australia's dark history of forced adoptions. Decades ago, Aboriginal children and children born to single mothers were wrenched from their parents, placed in new families, and denied access to their origins. Those forced placements did untold harm and convinced many Australians that adoption is an intrinsically harmful practice. That's simply false, as shown by the positive experiences of adoptees in many other countries. Modern-day open adoption, in which a child is allowed to learn about and, when appropriate, visit birth parents, is a far cry from the secretive practices of the past. It is designed to ensure that adopted children do not struggle with their identity. Australia's children in care deserve a family, and it needn't be the one they were born into. And now the last word, our in-depth article. The origins of ISIS. The terrorist group's rise was fueled by the chaos of Iraq, said Ian Fisher, and missed signals overseas. By the time the United States withdrew from its long bloody encounter with Iraq in 2010, it thought it had declawed a once fearsome enemy, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which had many names and incarnations, but at the time was neither fearsome nor a state. Beaten back by the American troop surge and Sunni tribal fighters, it was considered such a diminished threat that the bounty of the U.S. United States put on one of its leaders had dropped from $5 million to $100,000. The group's new chief was just 38 years old, a nearsighted cleric, not even a fighter, with little of the muscle of his predecessor, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the godfather of Iraq's insurgency, killed by American military 4 years earlier after a relentless hunt. "Where is the Islamic State of Iraq you are talking about?" the Yemeni wife of one leader demanded. According to the Iraqi police testimony, "We are living in the desert." Yet now, 5 years later, ISIS is on a very different trajectory. It has wiped clean a 100-year-old colonial border in the Middle East, controlling millions of people in Iraq and Syria. It has overcome its former partner and eventual rival, Al-Qaeda, first in battle, then as the world's preeminent jihadist group in reach and recruitment. It traces its origins both to the terrorist training grounds of Osama bin Laden's Afghanistan and to America's invasion of Iraq in 2003, and it achieved its resurgence through two single-minded means: control of territory and, by design, unspeakable cruelty. Its emblems are the black flag and the severed head. Since last spring, the group, also known as the Islamic State or ISIL, has been expanding beyond its local struggle to international terrorism. In the past 2 weeks, it did that in a spectacular way, first claiming responsibility for downing a Russian plane load of 224 people, then sending squads of killers who ended the lives of 43 people in Beirut and 129 in Paris. As the world scrambles to respond, the questions pile up like the dead. Who are they? What do they want? Were signals missed that could have stopped ISIS before it became so deadly? And there were, in fact, more than hints of the group's plans and potential. A 2012 report by the United States Defense Intelligence Agency was direct. The growing chaos in Syria's civil war was giving Islamic militants there and in Iraq the space to spread and flourish. The group, it said, could declare an Islamic State through its union with other terrorist organizations in Iraq and Syria. This particular report was one nobody wanted to see, said Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn, who ran the defense agency at the time. It was disregarded by the White House, he said. It was disregarded by other elements in the intelligence community as a one-off report. Frankly, at the White House, it didn't meet the narrative. There was a strong belief that brutal insurgencies fail, said William McCants of the Brookings Institution and a leading expert on ISIS, explaining the seeming indifference of American officials to the group's rise. The concept was that if you just leave ISIS alone, it would destroy itself, and so you didn't need to do much. There is no evidence that the two central figures in ISIS's ascendance ever met. But a faith in brutality, as a strategy unto itself, was a shared belief. Both were based in Iraq, seemingly a key to top leadership in ISIS. Otherwise, they could not be more different. The first, Zarqawi, a one-time thief, was a tattooed Jordanian and a reformed drinker of extreme personal violence, whose own mother had proclaimed him not very smart. The full details of the second, an Iraqi now known as Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the group's current and reclusive leader, are incomplete. But he is known more as a quiet Sunni cleric, likely with an advanced degree in Islamic studies, whose tribe traces its lineage to the Prophet Muhammad himself. He liked soccer. Each was shaped by the larger forces of the Islamic world, in particular religious zeal, al-Qaeda, and America's war with Iraq. Each rejected the secular culture of the West, which many say was the target of the attacks in Paris. As difficult as it might be for Americans to believe that after September 11 terrorist attacks and more than a decade of thinking of bin Laden as the basest terrorist planner, Zarqawi was perhaps more violent and more apocalyptic in his outlook than the al-Qaeda leader. He grew up poor in the industrial Jordanian city of Zarqa, in a two-story concrete house with seven sisters and two brothers. His youth was spent as a petty criminal, but after adopting a strict form of Islam, he turned to jihad and traveled to Pakistan and Afghanistan, where he actually met with bin Laden. Al-Qaeda, though, was hesitant about letting him join, an early sign of a rivalry that would fester into a final split years later. While he had a reputation as a thug, Zarqawi demonstrated keen instincts for strategic thinking. He clearly saw that the United States would invade Iraq, slipping into the country in 2003, and by some accounts setting up sleeper cells to attack the invaders. Later, he took full advantage of America's marginalization of Saddam Hussein's ruthless Ba'athist soldiers and bureaucracy. Stoking both attacks against American soldiers and tensions with Shiites, he built an insurgency responsible for keystone moments of the early war: assaults on the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad, the Shiite Imam Ali Mosque, and other targets large and small. The United States raised the bounty on him to $25 million, equal to that for bin Laden. But the videoed decapitations and wanton sectarian killings of Muslim civilians, along with his desire to proclaim as an Islamic State, also provoked an unusual rebuke in 2005 from bin Laden's number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, now the top leader of al-Qaeda. Beheadings, Zawahiri wrote, may stir the passions of zealous young men, but ordinary Muslims will never find them palatable. An American airstrike finally killed Zarqawi in June 2006. 4 months later, his successor declared the founding of the Islamic State of Iraq. It was one of scores of Sunni groups fighting mostly in northern Iraq, and accounts differ as to how effective or distinct it was. Still, Rod Coffey, in March 2008, an American lieutenant colonel, recalls vividly finding ISIS's black, gold-fringed banner some 50 miles north of Baghdad. These were people who, unlike bin Laden, said, "We are going to control ground now, create a government, create a society, run this place as a stepping stone to creating a caliphate." Coffey, now 54 and retired, said, "Near the flag, he found a mass grave of 30 bodies, executed." McCants, the Brookings scholar, has done deep research into the origins of Baghdadi, the current leader of ISIS, but much remains unclear. In his book, The ISIS Apocalypse, McCants traces the rise of a lower middle class man born in 1971 in the hardline Sunni city of Samarra, Iraq. Baghdadi's family ties to Saddam Hussein's army were strong. His own bad eyesight would keep him from active duty. Apart from his piety, one fact is not in dispute. Baghdadi is a former inmate of Camp Bucca, the American prison in southern Iraq, now widely agreed to have been crucial in the formation of Iraqi jihadists, housed in proximity behind blast walls and spools of razor wire. It earned names like the Academy or Jihadi University, where the United States would unintentionally create the conditions ripe for training a new generation of insurgents. In ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror, authors Michael Weiss and Hassan Hassan quote Major General Douglas Stone, a prison commander in Iraq. "If you were looking to build an army, prison is the perfect place to do it. We gave them health care, dental, fed them, and most importantly, we kept them from being killed in combat." Looking back this week, John Brennan, the CIA director, recounted in a speech to a Washington think tank that ISIS was pretty much decimated when U.S. forces were there in Iraq. The group had maybe 700 or so adherents left. Brennan said, "And then it grew quite a bit." Americans wanted to believe that the Iraq War had ended in triumph and the troops were soon withdrawn. But almost immediately, tensions began rising between the Sunnis and the Shiite-dominated government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, supported by the United States and Iran, the Shiite giant to the east. Salaries and jobs promised to the cooperating tribes were not paid. There seemed little room for Sunnis in the new Iraq. The old Sunni insurgents began to look appealing again. Baghdadi was named head of ISIS in 2010, and his group seemed particularly adept at exploiting Sunni fears. McCants recounts how they entered a period of concentrated reflection, developed a detailed military precise plan for resurrection in 2009. The document, parts of which are translated in McCants' book, is strikingly self-critical, acknowledging that ISIS had lost some of its aggressiveness and did not control territory. It advised adopting the American tactic of co-opting the Sunni tribes, conceding that the U.S. is recruiting the tribes to eliminate the Mujahideen was a clever, bold idea. The document also makes clear the need for a media strategy, a recommendation the group went on to follow with great success, exploiting social media to spread its message and to attract recruits, many in the more technologically savvy West. Then a civil war broke out in Syria, a new and promising front for ISIS's ambitions. Early on, ISIS's rivals underestimated it, only to face deadly attacks from the group later. They were not the only ones. Obama likened the group to the JV team, and ISIS fighters often did seem like buffoons, especially the foreign ones who came from across the Middle East, Central Asia, and Europe. Many could not speak any Arabic, and some barely knew anything about Islamic theology. They posted on social media pictures of themselves mugging for the camera as they swam in the Euphrates River, or complaining that it was difficult to find Nutella in the shops. But some were serious, determined, and ideologically motivated. "I have chosen the state," one man who identified himself as a Saudi fighter said in an online interview, explaining that his interest was less in overthrowing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad than in striving for a caliphate, "because I support its method of unification and implementation of the Sharia of God." ISIS did, in fact, succeed in building the semblance of a state, providing services as well as imposing the harshest rules. It worked to self-finance through oil, trade in priceless antiquities, and, many say, simple criminal enterprises like kidnapping and extortion. And, as it had always promised, ISIS was brutal, frightening fellow groups with wider world with practices like sexual slavery, immolations, crucifixions, and beheadings. Those included killings of the journalist James Foley and others in well-produced videos that spread through social media, ending often with a shot of a bloody, severed head. The climax of ISIS's rise came in June 2014 when it captured Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city, erasing the century-old border between Iraq and Syria, and established after World War I. The caliphate had been declared the month before, but soon after Mosul's capture, Baghdadi, in a black SUV, arrived at the Nuri Mosque in Mosul in a rare appearance to make that state formal. There was another victory which had played out behind the scenes in bitter missives between Al-Qaeda Central, ISIS, and its Qaeda-sponsored affiliate, the Nusra Front. Baghdadi rejected demands from Zawahiri, leader of Al-Qaeda after bin Laden's death, that he step in line under his rule. "No," Baghdadi said, "ISIS was supreme and separate. Al-Qaeda Central had become, in some sense, the cautious, increasingly irrelevant uncle. Paris was the proof of that." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. On the health and science page, saved by an experimental cancer treatment. A British toddler dying of an aggressive form of leukemia has been saved by an experimental treatment using designer immune cells genetically engineered to destroy cancer. Diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia at 3 months old, Layla Richards spent the better part of her infancy undergoing a barrage of treatments, including chemotherapy and bone marrow transplants. None was successful. Layla's parents were told she had only months to live, but they refused to give up. "We asked the doctors to try anything for our daughter, even if it hadn't been tried before," her mother, Lisa Richards, tells NBCNews.com. In a last-ditch attempt to save the girl's life, a team at London's Great Ormond Street Hospital performed an experimental procedure known as gene editing, previously tested only in mice. First, new genes engineered to attack leukemia cells were injected into immune system cells, called T cells, from a healthy donor. Then doctors used enzymes that act as molecular scissors to render those genes impervious to leukemia drugs and prevent them from attacking healthy cells. Several months after receiving the infusion of the genetically engineered T cells, Layla is cancer-free. Doctors say it's too soon to say she's cured, but the technique could represent a significant advance in cancer treatment. We didn't know if or when it would work, and so we were over the moon when it did, said Dr. Paul Vase. Her leukemia was so aggressive that such a response is almost a miracle. Lower blood pressure is better. Current blood pressure standards are too high, and aggressively treating people now considered healthy can prevent more heart attacks and strokes and save lives, a new National Institutes of Health study has concluded. Under existing clinical guidelines, healthy adults should have a systolic blood pressure of 140 or lower. In a study of 9,361 adults 50 or older, researchers randomly assigned participants to receive either standard hypertension treatment or more intensive therapy aimed at lowering their systolic blood pressure to 120 or below. Over the course of the three-year trial, the people treated more aggressively experienced 25% fewer heart attacks, strokes, and other cardiovascular events. Deaths among these patients also dropped by 43%. The general message here seems to be that lower seems to be better, study leader Paul Welton tells Time.com. Aggressive treatment does raise the chances of side effects, but Welton says that the benefits of the lower blood pressure far outweigh the potential for risk. Finishing up on the talking points page, immigration, Cruz and Rubio collide. The marquee fight of the Republican race has finally arrived, said Tal Copan and Theodore Schleifer in CNN.com. With Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz increasingly looking like the party's most viable candidates, the two senators are taking the gloves off over one of the most explosive debates among conservatives, immigration. At the heart of the battle is Rubio's central role in the so-called Gang of Eight, the bipartisan group of senators who tried and failed to enact comprehensive immigration reform in 2013. Cruz criticized Rubio last week for trying to jam this amnesty down the American people's throats. Rubio responded by noting that at the time, Cruz actually proposed legalizing people who were here illegally by expanding the number of temporary visas and green cards. Ironically, Cruz's proposals were designed to divide Republican support and thus kill the bill, said Brian Beutler in NewRepublic.com. But having wooed anti-establishment conservatives with his supposed orthodoxy and candor, he may find it awkward to explain that he was just gaming the Washington system all along. Rubio's involvement in the Gang of Eight was a colossal political and policy misjudgment, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. While he eventually abandoned his own handiwork and declared the bill a mistake, there is, understandably, lingering distrust among conservatives. Rubio needs to offer some detailed promises to secure the border, promises that would exact a real political price if he ever backtracked on them. Even that wouldn't be enough, said Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. The only way Rubio can prevent this issue from sinking him in the primaries is to frame the discussion on immigration on his own terms. How? By addressing the matter in a big speech like JFK did on his Catholic faith and Barack Obama did on the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Democrats must be loving this, said Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com. On the one side, there's Rubio, who's been trying to show younger, poor, newer, less white Americans that the GOP gives a damn about them. On the other side, there's Cruz, a man who combines Sarah Palin's worldview, Richard Nixon's commitment to fair play, and Al Gore's folksy charm. Rubio is clearly the candidate Democrats fear most, yet he's the one being forced to take increasingly extreme positions that will be an albatross in the general election. Somewhere, a woman in a pantsuit is laughing. And some short notes as we finish up. Life expectancy in Syria has dropped from 74.7 years in 2005, before the country's brutal civil war, to 55.7 years today. Despite efforts to improve the American diet and lifestyle, like First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, the percentage of obese Americans has actually increased. About 38% of U.S. adults were obese in 2013 and 14, compared with 35% in 2011 and 2012. Baltimore recorded its 300th homicide of the year last weekend, up 42% from 2014's overall total. The number of killings has surged in the city since it was hit by rioting over the death of a black man in police custody in April. On the poll watch, 56% of Americans believe that the values of Islam are at odds with America's values and way of life, up from 47% in 2011. And finally, a quote. This comes from Whoopi Goldberg. Ms. Goldberg says, "Normal is just a cycle on the washing machine." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.